You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an immigration law and policy expert tells us what could happen at the U.S. border with Mexico if the public health order known as Title 42 expires next month. Now, did you give much thought to the design and the label on the last can of beer you drank? Or where that can went after it somehow became empty? Andrew Borkstrom of Waukesha thinks about beer cans a lot. He's been collecting them and other beer memorabilia, especially those from Waukesha, since he was a kid. Andrew's a member of the beer can collecting club, the Badger Bunch, based in the greater Milwaukee area. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's great. Thanks.
Andrew, how did you get started on beer can collecting?
Well, my father worked for American Can Company years ago, and he used to bring cans home and put them on the table because he worked third shift. And then before school, I'd put them on the shelf, go down to the basement, rearrange them, kind of learn my alphabet by sorting beer cans.
Now, can you give us a taste of what your collection looks like right now?
Well, right now, it's actually changed over the years a little bit. We kept all the Waukesha stuff. We used to have, I'd say well over 10,000 cans, but you can't display 10,000 cans. So we kind of went down to just Wisconsin, and then we went down to just Waukesha, and then I collect straight steel cans, which straight steel ended about 1975. And what that is they just changed the way they made the can. There's no crimp in it. Before they made the crimp, they made thinner steel. So I have about 3,000 straight steel cans, and I have about 72 different Waukesha cans.
And as I mentioned, you're part of a group. This isn't just, people at home doing this. There's kind of a community of beer can collectors. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, yeah. The Badger Bunch has been around since 1972. The BCCA, originally the Beer Can Collectors of America, started in 1971. And Wisconsin, being very beer-oriented, had the first chapter. And that was the Badger Bunch. And we've been going for 50 years.
There are meetings, there are conventions, except, did I read this right? They're called canventions?
Oh, yeah, the canvention. Every year we have the National Canvention somewhere in the United States. It's the National Canvention. This year, it's in September. It's awesome. You get about, I'd say, well over 1,000 people.
Wow.
Showing up at the canvention. For cans, it's not just beer cans either. It's soda cans, there's anything that's associated with the brewery.
What are the ones, that I couldn't pry out of your hands for any amount of money? What are your couple of favorite cans in your collection?
Oh, that would be my father's cans that I collected with him, the Waukesha ones. Waukesha has a very unique history with water and beer. The Foxhead Brewery, the Weber Brewery. My dad would go to estate sales and we'd go all over the place dumping for cans and old dumps, and we'd take the rust off using acetic acid and clean them up. So those I wouldn't part with for anything.
And you're passing this on to a new generation now, right? Your son is in the game?
Yeah, my son's here with me. We're sitting here right now, and he's got his own little collection going.
Now, I always like to ask this of collectors, is there a holy grail? Like, Andrew, that one you really wish you had in your collection, if you could only find it?
There's a couple of holy grails in the sense that, like, the Waukesha holy grails. I just found recently a friend of my father's passed away, and he left me the Waukesha Fox Deluxe Bock, which is a really rare can. There's the first beer can. The first beer can was roughly 1935 area. It was from Kruger's. American Can Company came up with that the flat top, and they wanted to test it, but the brewery didn't want to test it in their own market area, so they tested it on the East Coast in Richmond, Virginia. And there was only so many of them produced, and one was just recently found a few years back, and it's the only known one. I'd love to have that one in my collection.
Wow. I got to ask, are you a fan of the contents of these beer cans? Do you enjoy beer, or is it all about the container for you?
Yeah, I do. I'm more of a craft drinker. I like good beer. I spent a lot of time in Germany in the military, so I got to drink really good beer in my time. So I have a lot of craft breweries here in Waukesha. They started a brewery called Base Brand. Go ahead.
We're losing you there, Andrew, but I'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's a fun hobby. we have a lot of good things coming up, and check out the website.
Awesome. That's Andrew Borgstrom of Waukesha, a member of the Badger Bunch Beer Can Collecting Club. He joins us today to talk about his collection and the hobby of beer can and other memorabilia collecting. Coming up, we talk about the CDC's plan to lift a border-related health policy that came in during the Trump administration. It's known as Title 42. We'll find out why it's got some Democrats trying to distance themselves from that move. That's coming up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, find out why there's growing alarm that the U.S. Supreme Court is deciding more cases in private and with little explanation. Jen White sheds light on what's known as the shadow docket. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, an immigration and public health order under a law known as Title 42 is set to expire in about a month. President Biden is not planning to extend it, but that's got some lawmakers of both parties worried about what could happen at the U.S.-Mexico border without it. Rick Sue is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. He teaches and writes about local government law, immigration, and federalism. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Tell us, first of all, about Title 42. It's something that's been around for a while. What is it, and how has it been applied in the last couple of years at the U.S.-Mexico border?
Yeah, so Title 42 is actually a 1944 law about the spread of communicable diseases. It's actually the same law that the CDC used to impose the mask mandate, which, of course, was recently struck down. But the Trump administration in 2020 essentially used a specific provision to prohibit, because of COVID risk, immigrants from coming into this country. And more importantly, because it circumvents immigration law, it would also prevent them from seeking asylum. So it's important to note the law itself doesn't have anything to do with immigration. In fact, it applies to everyone, including citizens. But it has been recently used as an immigration measure. And in fact, kind of trumps our standard immigration process.
And it seems like the biggest effect has been on people who would have been seeking asylum. So what happens differently in that case? Somebody's trying to cross the border, hoping to claim asylum. What has been happening under Title 42 in most of those instances?
Yeah, so since 2020, essentially what has happened is they've been turned back. There is a special deal right now with Mexico. So individuals are coming from that are Mexican or Guatemalan, Honduran, or from El Salvador, they are returned back to Mexico. We actually have a surge now of immigrants from other countries. Those three countries are actually going down a little bit. And those people are taken to custody, but then immediately returned to their country of origin. Often with a flight. But as you noted before, instead of going to apply for the asylum process itself, which has its own procedures, this just circumvents that, and they are sent back to either Mexico or their country of origin.
Do we have a sense of how many people have been affected by this?
Yeah, it's estimated about 1.7 million people have been expelled under Title 42. And in a given month, comes out to be about 50% of individuals that are encountered, including those seeking asylum. There are some exceptions for unaccompanied minors that the Biden administration put in and families or particularly individuals who are particularly vulnerable. But 50% is a large number, especially considering that they're not being expelled for immigration in some ways and immigration law, but under this health-related measure.
Talking to Rick Sue from the University of North Carolina School of Law, looking at this health policy that's been used at the U.S.-Mexico border to prevent many people coming in during COVID. You could join in if you have questions or thoughts on Title 42 at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So as I mentioned at the start, Rick, this use of Title 42 set to expire in about a month. Why is that coming to an end?
Yeah, so in some ways, it makes perfect sense. We're rolling back on COVID restrictions. In fact, Title 42 was about essentially barring people who have a serious danger of introducing a communicable disease into the United States. Given the statistics show that actually it's COVID is higher in the United States than most of the places that these people are coming from, I think it's become incredibly hard, at least to justify under the law, that we're excluding them to prevent the introduction of COVID, given that it's already here. So those, I think, are the reasons why they want to remove it. In some ways, it's just gone well beyond, I think, what the law allows at this particular point.
There's concern from Republican critics of President Biden, but also from Democratic allies who are worried that the expiration of this use of Title 42 is potentially going to bring a lot of people showing up at the border hoping to claim asylum. What are some of the possible consequences you're looking at?
Yeah, so it does show that in some ways, despite the fact that Title 42 is about COVID and about communicable diseases, that it's really become quite useful as a immigration exclusion tool. In fact, a way of getting immigration reform, if you will, without actually going through Congress and doing immigration reform, given that it suspends asylum. There are some estimates that there would be more people seeking asylum if Title 42 does not prevent them from doing so. Now, whether or not that's a problem depends on how you see immigration, because seeking asylum, of course, is a legal process under our immigration laws. But certainly for a lot of individuals that want to get rid of asylum or severely limit it, which was, of course, the goal of the Trump administration, that was seen as a negative. So therefore, the likelihood that taking out Title 42 and going through the normal immigration process would increase people seeking asylum is then seen as a potential problem. But it does show that the politics of immigration right now seems to be against not only immigrants, but also people seeking asylum.
There are logistical concerns, too. I mean, I've talked to other guests about an asylum backlog, a lot of immigration court backlogs going on right now. If one day Title 42 is being used in this way, the next day it isn't, that could lead to a bigger caseload for people involved in these processes. Are we ready for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially the question that's being asked right now. The only sort of issue coming out of that is whether or not the Biden administration can provide enough assurances to satisfy everyone. So the Biden administration has announced that they have been making plans, that they are anticipating that there would be a surge in asylum processing, and that a more detailed plan would be rolled out soon. And certainly a lot of this would be with regard to essentially detention capacity, certainly COVID mitigation processes, but also sort of individuals that would be released into the country awaiting asylum proceedings. I think the problem here is how that process is seen, because certainly a success from one perspective, which is the efficient or sort of normal operation, the asylum process, will certainly be cast as a negative from the opposite side of the aisle in this particular case. Most likely that these individuals will be applying for asylum and that many of them may be released into the country pending their hearing. And that would be seen as essentially the negative. So essentially, it's really a debate about asylum policy and the asylum process, and less so about the medical and health concerns under Title 42.
This is, of course, an election year. There's been some attention on swing state Democrats running for election or re-election in the Senate, worried that an increase in the number of people seeking asylum and overload in the system could have a political impact this year. How big a factor do you see that being in how this law gets applied and talked about?
Yeah, I think the fact that asylum is seen as a big concern sort of reflects in some ways the political climate we're in right now. And I think Democrats are realizing that. The problem, I think, is in some ways the Biden administration's in a little bit of a lose-lose situation. If they repeal Title 42 and there is any increase in the encounters at the border, and it could be increases that just has to do with weather, right? Not necessarily the repeal of 42, it'll be blamed on the repeal. And even if the process is working out exactly the way they had planned, the way it's working out, the applying for asylum will be cast as a negative. But even they keep Title 42, I think their Biden administration is going to get attacked from the left. There might still be a surge, because one thing that Title 42 has done is, because there's no immigration consequences to exclusion, a lot of people just try to come back over and over again, therefore increasing the encounter counts. Not to mention that this essentially then continues to suspend asylum in a way that is increasingly disconnected from the health-related reason for this particular measure. So it really is seemingly effectuating immigration reform in a way that doesn't actually require any congressional action and giving the GOP a win in that. So I think Biden is in a very difficult position with this.
Is the use of Title 42 in this way, again, a health regulation being used as a border regulation, is it an on-off switch? Is there some sort of like graduated exit from it that would be possible?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's within the discretion and supposed to be connected to, again, the danger of the communicable disease. So it should expire. But of course, there is some complication with regard to a litigation, a lawsuit that is coming in that will then try to keep Title 42 on. Not to mention the fact that if we get into this precedent, which again, Title 42 has not been used as an immigration measure. But if this remains, and this remains for a long time, or many of the bills that are coming out to continue Title 42, this may be sort of a backdoor to dealing with immigration reform without really talking about immigration by itself. Not to mention the fact that Title 42 has actually been ruled by a court recently to not grant the administration that much powers over the mask mandate. So we're in the strange position where, on the one hand, we say Title 42 shouldn't really justify all these COVID restrictions, but on the other hand, saying that, well, it certainly can be used as a backdoor, to do immigration exclusion.
Talking to law professor Rick Hsu about this Title 42, a health measure being used to block asylum claims at the U.S.-Mexico border. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. I'm actually dealing with the immigration system right now. I'm trying to immigrate my wife over here from England. And I guess my question is Americans trying to immigrate people from out of country? Are we in the same line as these people trying to immigrate in from the southern border?
Tim, an interesting question, Rick.
Yeah, so two components to that question. So with regard to the immigration quotas that allow people in, there are different lines. So most of these individuals that are coming in through the southern border are seeking asylum. So that's in a different queue, that's a different system, and of course they have to prove their case. And the fact is, most people do not prove their case. So many of them have at least their day in court, but they are sort of removed. With regard to, at least it sounds like in this case, that would be in the family-based immigration system, which has a different line. So I know we like to talk about lines, but there's really different quotas and different systems, and they don't necessarily take away from one or the other. One thing that is interesting, though, is the application of Title 42. And I think one of the complaints about it is that it's always been selectively applied. So even though it's about COVID and about COVID risk, it's really being applied in some ways to people from certain countries and not others. And in fact, we're going to see this come up because right now there's an exemption for Title 42 for Ukrainian asylum applicants, but that's going to expire at the end of this week. So we'll see whether or not people are still really committed to the health-related concerns or whether or not this is really a selective means of allowing certain people in and not others.
Tim, thanks for that call. Rick, at the heart of this is, I think, that Congress has talked about significant immigration reform, significant immigration change for 20, 30 years or so. Not much came out of that. So we end up this with a situation where executive orders are used, or authorities like Title 42 are used, flipped back and forth, maybe between a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. We're kind of just kludging our way through this system.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. And I think the problem now isn't that we can't come to some sort of immigration compromise, but there seems to be actually very little political will to actually get to a compromise. I think immigration has become so useful as a political tool for winning elections that in some ways doing nothing about it seems to be what everyone wants so they can continue to hammer each other with it. Because actually getting down to the business of dealing with the system then raises really important questions about, do we still believe in asylum or our international obligations with regard to that? What kind of immigrants do we need? Especially now with essentially a labor shortage, we should be thinking about immigration in a different way. But no one seems to be interested in having those conversations. And in some ways, I think one thing that came out of, to be fair, both Obama and the Trump administration is these creative uses of all these different areas of the law to essentially implement immigration policy. And I think in some ways, many political actors are seeing that as much more of a flexible way to deal with it, and maybe more politically advantageous than actually getting down to the serious business of lawmaking.
So here we are counting down to the expected expiration of this Title 42 order. We've got Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas meeting with other leaders from Western countries about getting help with managing migrants, trying to work with Mexico, Central America, other countries. Is there much opportunity to help smooth out this situation by cooperating with other countries involved?
Yeah, I think that's definitely. Yeah, I think that's definitely the goal in some ways, because what we're dealing with here is not necessarily how our system works, but essentially decisions that are outside of our control, which is individuals seeking to come to the border and seek relief there. So one thing that is interesting is I had mentioned before that Title 42 will be reintroduced to Ukrainian asylum applicants. Well, the reason they're doing that is because they want to redirect them to a different system in which they would apply for asylum from Europe instead of showing up at the southern border. So in some ways, that's the dream that essentially many administrations have wanted to do with regard to individuals arriving in the southern border. So maybe if we see this, process, this uniting for Ukrainian program, if that ends up working out, that might be a good model for how we might handle these other issues with regard to countries in the southern border.
So, just briefly, could that mean someone in Central America under that kind of system could apply for asylum from their home country instead of trying to cross the southern border?
Yeah, I think that's the goal, and that's been talked about for many years. Now, there are challenges, right? So getting a country to agree for its own citizens to apply for asylum based on some sort of danger of that country, that's hard, right? It's hard to get a country to sort of allow that to happen. Let's say applying at the sort of embassy or something like that. It's easier for Ukraine because they're applying in Europe. They're outside Ukraine at that particular point. But certainly, I think that's the goal because there is a lot of danger and risk to making the journey to the southern border, besides the administrative cost, if you will, to the United States. But setting that up, getting cooperation, I think that's going to be a difficult process. And they've been trying it. But certainly, whether or not that gets some sort of fruition is going to be up to time and some good diplomacy.
Rick, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That's Rick Hsu, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law, joining us for a look at the upcoming expected expiration of a public health and immigration order called Title 42 and what it means at the U.S. southern border. Tomorrow on Central Time, there are always calls to teach kids more financial literacy in schools, but what should they learn? We'll get some ideas coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then what causes one conflict to erupt into war and another to remain peaceful? We'll talk to an expert in global conflict studies about his new book, Why We Fight. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the European Union has new regulations on social media companies aimed in part at stopping the flow of misinformation. We'll check in on the potential for creating a less divisive, more informative online experience. First, Russia's war in Ukraine is in its second month, and as of now, there's no sign of a slowdown in fighting. Our next guest says most conflicts usually don't end up this way. He says more often war is the exception, not the rule. That's because there's more upside even in a bitter compromise than in a long and deadly fight. That's true whether we're talking about international conflict or a local dispute among gangs. We're talking about the causes of war and what brings about peace, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If I asked you, what are the main things that cause war, what's your answer? Does it feel to you like peace is more or less common than war? Do you think we focus too much on the causes of war instead of looking for ways to prevent it and maintain peace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Christopher Blattman is an economist and political scientist who studies global conflict, crime, and poverty at the University of Chicago. His new book is called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I think coming out of my early history education, Chris, sometimes history looks like a series of one war and then another war and another war. But I want to quote from your book here. You write, "Wars shouldn't happen, and most of the time they don't. War is the exception, not the rule." Can you talk about why that is?
Right. I mean, it's natural for our attention to be drawn to, I mean, just the horror that's going on right now. You know, just like a doctor should be paying attention to the critically ill. But we want our doctors to remember that most people are healthy. And so I want people to remember that most of us don't go to war. And, you know, a good example came 2 weeks into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, when India accidentally lobbed a cruise missile at Pakistan, and Common sued, just as it has for decades between these two countries that are tense, you know, are tensely competing, but generally it's not violent. Another example is, you know, school children are going to learn for about the invasion of Afghanistan for decades, and very few of them are going to learn about the U.S. invasion of Haiti in 1994 when Colin Powell went, confronted the dictator, said, look, if you don't hand power back to a Democrat, the democratically elected president, here's a video of dozens of American planes taking off full of troops and equipment. And that was 2 hours ago. They're almost here. And he capitulated immediately. And so, but these sort of quiet moments of compromise slip from our memory.
The incentive in most cases among potentially violently conflicting parties is for peace, you write. Why is that? Why do the costs of going to war ultimately usually end up being prohibitive?
Well, just look what's happening now. Just the death, the destruction, the cities turned to rubble, the sons going home in body bags from the front, the civilians killed, the treasuries that are emptying on both sides. And it's so prohibitively costly that I say enemies prefer to loathe in peace. And frankly, you know, we risk forgetting that. We risk forgetting that Putin spent the last 20 years trying to co-opt the Ukraine in every other insidious way possible, save war, assassinations, dark money, propaganda, support for separatists, and so on. It really, like in so many cases, it's either not used at all, and when it's used, it's often a last resort.
In spite of this powerful disincentive to war, obviously we do have war, and you list five things, five different, I guess, categories of things that lead us into war. I want to check in with each of them. First of all, and this one seems very relevant, unchecked interests. If I'm the person who's deciding whether to go to war, and I personally am very insulated from the consequences of that war, as it seems, for example, Vladimir Putin is, that takes away some of that disincentive. How does that factor into wars?
Well, so he pays some of these costs of war. He's certainly under some risks, and it's his treasury that's emptying. But because he's insulated, he doesn't have to worry about the ordinary deprivations of his citizens or those who are getting killed, so he can afford to ignore. He also, you know, precisely because he's trying to preserve an autocratic regime, that it's part of his incentive to invade the Ukraine because he's trying to exterminate this democratic example on his border. There's lots of motivations for him to go in there, but one of them is the fact that here's a place that's had two democratic revolutions in 20 years, tossing out Russian-facing dictators. That's a pretty dangerous example from Putin's point of view to Russian dissidents, and he'd like to exterminate that example.
Another reason, another misconception that can lead parties into war is, and this kind of relates to what you're just saying, intangible incentives. People aren't just making cold economic calculations. What could this war cost me? What could the financial or economic benefit? How do these play into it?
Right. And I would say, you know, this idea that he's going to get turfed out and strung up and, you know, he has these visions of ending up like Gaddafi is a very tangible worry for him. But there are all these stories that we hear that I think are true. I mean, no one really knows what's in Putin's mind. But when you hear a story that says he's seeking glory or a place in history, or maybe something larger than himself, he's seeking a return to Soviet power. He wants to counter the humiliation of the Soviet Union. You know, you hear all these stories, and all of these are these intangible incentives. They're things that he's willing to pay the cost. So it's not that he's ignoring the costs because he's not accountable for them. Rather, this is a whole bunch of things where he's saying, no, there's something that war will get me, an invasion will get me, that nothing else will, and I'm willing to pay it for this sort of intangible ideological payoff.
We're talking to Christopher Blattman, author of the new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace, looking at why incentives toward peace sometimes break down, whether we're talking about international conflict or a local conflict among gangs, a local civil war. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about why war happens, how we can prevent it. That's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, I want to step aside from those causes of war for a moment to look at a different scale. I thought this was a really interesting example. You spent time in Colombia talking in prisons to leaders of organized crime organizations. What did you learn there about what led to a very violent period to a substantially less violent period?
So, you know, I start off the book telling a story about how speaking to one of these leaders in prison, he told me about a fight that broke out in his cell block over a game of billiards that got out of hand really fast. One side pulled out their guns and fired on the other. And why they're carrying guns in prison is probably a whole other radio show. But what happened was what you would predict next is a series of vindictive killings and essentially the beginnings of a blood feud. And the city's gangs all lined up behind one side or the other, and basically the city geared for war. But as I said, you know, nobody wants a war. It's too expensive. You know, you don't, if you're drugging, you don't sell any retail drugs in a gunfight. And the big bosses in the city, you sort of lose the invisibility that's their shield. And so there's all these incentives to find a way to back down. And those gangs are unchecked, like you said. They might have their own intangible incentives. That's what revenge is. That's what vengeance is. So those two we just went through. So those are two reasons to ignore the costs. But there's still this powerful incentive towards pulling them towards peace. And if it wasn't there, what happened is these upper-level leaders, these mafia-like organizations called Razones, who are the leaders of whom we meet and have been trying to understand how they work, are more than happy to promise sanctions, maybe at the point of a gun, are more than happy to provide them a bargaining table to get rid of some of the uncertainty and the misperceptions that they have, are more than willing to uphold deals that they make and actually put a lot of pressure on them to make deals. They're a little bit like the UN Security Council of the city. They call it L'Oficina, or the office. And if the gangs ever fail to see that incentive and ignore the costs and therefore start to go to war, for the last 10 years, this L'Oficina has been really effective at helping them keep the peace. And so the murder rate is probably a third of what it is here in my home city of Chicago.
What lessons are there if we're looking to de-escalate a violent conflict among maybe some pretty bad actors, whether it's in a big American city or in a war-torn country facing a civil war? How can we, if we're the UN, the local government, whatever, how can we think about incentives when our first instinct might be to just say, we got to punish the bad actors?
Yeah, I mean, starts with remembering one thing. If war is incredibly costly, if it's ruinous, every answer to why we fight is a reason that one side or the other ignores those costs. And the first two examples we went through, leaders are unchecked, intangible incentives, are reasons to ignore those costs. You flip this around, every path to peace is actually a way to get both parties to pay attention to the costs that they're ignoring or giving them counter incentives to the things that are leading them to ignore those costs. And so when we think about sanctions, so everyone is familiar with international sanctions, and the ones that were placed as a threat were threatened to be placed on Putin if he invaded and were not enough to deter him, but surely made him think twice and made many other dictators think twice. That's a great example of countering unchecked leaders' intangible incentives. The same tools get used to counter cartels. So the Colombian government, the Mexican government, go to the drug cartels and they say, you want our military and our police to put you away to sort of dedicate our resources to your neighborhood? Well, let the bodies keep dropping. And Colombia's been very effective at this. And it's one of the reasons that I think it's been as peaceful as it has the last 10 or 20 years. U.S. cities have a program called Focus Deterrence. It's exactly the same thing. It's targeted sanctions. It's saying, going to the gangs and saying, if violence appears in your neighborhood, we're going to come down on you. So stop it. And that also seems to be fairly effective. So at every level, countering these incentives, compelling unchecked leaders to internalize some of these costs seems to be reasonably, it's not a mass solution, but it helps.
We're talking to Chris Blattman, economist and political scientist who studies global conflict at the University of Chicago. We're talking to him about his new book. It's called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the things that drive war, ongoing violent conflict, locally or internationally? What are the things that are important to you to keep peace? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to University of Chicago economist Christopher Blattman about his new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about why war breaks out, why peace more commonly persists, even during tough conflicts. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. The guy David Graeber, who was an anthropologist or an archaeologist, I forget which, wrote a book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And in that book, he describes the process of money creation on the part of the state or the imperialist. In that process, the claim made by the imperialist is that they get to create what the people must use for money in order that they pay their taxes. So if we continue to believe that at the very top, the creation of money is something that is done by authoritarian dictate, and then we have to pay our taxes in that form, then the populace has to do whatever it is that the imperialist declares. And if the imperialist wants to go to war, in order for you to get your taxes paid, you have to pay in money, which the imperialist can create out of thin air.
Mark, thanks for the call. That gets, Chris, I think, to your point, ultimately, of unchecked interest. Does the person at the top, who's, if, among other things, minting the money, get to make these decisions regardless of the meaning for the populace?
Yeah, and you know what else is interesting to me is I think imperialism, the way he's just described it, which I think is just right, is actually an example of the incentives for peace. I mean, the sad fact is most of human history, most human societies, the small elites dominated the masses, and there were some popular revolts, but for the most part, people were subjugated. So that was not violent. So there's nothing that says peace has to be equal. Peace is just the fact that the weak often don't have the incentives to rise up against the strong. And that's actually the unfortunate consequence in some ways of these powerful incentives and of the costs of war. And only occasionally do you get a colonized people like the Ukrainians who say, no way, we're not going to stand for this. We're not going to take this raw deal on offer, and we're going to fight, even though it's ruinous. We're going to fight out of an intangible incentive for this desire for liberty, for rightness. And so I think imperialism is a great example of these sort of sad, it's the sad implication of the incentives towards peace.
Mark, thanks for the call. Go to Marcus now in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Professor Glavin, I'm a little surprised it hasn't come up yet, but when it comes to this topic, the U.S., is the final expert. Since 1776, the U.S. has been at war 93% of the time, and there are only 21 total years where we weren't at war. There's never been a U.S. president that was a peacetime president. And the U.S. only went 5 consecutive years without a war during the isolationist period of the Depression. So 222 out of 239 years, we have been at war.
Marcus, thanks for the call. It'll, of course, depend, I think, on your definition of war and justifications for individual moments. But that said, Marcus's point, Chris, that the U.S. has spent a goodly amount of time at war. Have we learned lessons?
Right. I mean, listen, I didn't write a book called Why We Don't Fight, you know, because he's right. Like, there is an awful lot of war. There's certainly too much. And the United States has been at war far more than I would like it to be. So I'm sympathetic to this. I guess my point, if I want people to remember one thing, it's to actually, if we want to put this in perspective and we want to understand, we could talk about specific wars, because I think every one that the U.S. has been involved in is different. I think it's all sort of comes down to this one thing, that war is costly, and every answer to why America has fought is it's had some reason, strategic or otherwise, to ignore those costs. And so if we want to understand war, it's just useful to start with that counter incentive and then try to understand, you know, why we ignore it.
Chris Blattman is with us, author of the new book, Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. You look at things that help prevent war or solve war. One of the solutions is an interdependence among people in a community, in a society, or with their international neighbors. One concern here in the U.S. is that with increased polarization, we're in less contact. We're in maybe less interdependence with one another. Do you worry that that could lead to internal violence here in the United States?
So I think the risk is tiny, but it's not zero, and that should be terrifying. And so I think we have to take it very seriously. I agree, like a society that is not polarized, that's where we're socially and economically intermingled. The more socially and economically intermingled we are, the more we have empathy for the other side, the less likely you are to go to war. Because not only is war costly to me, war's costly to you. And I care a little bit about you at least. And that's going to make war more costly in my vision. But, you know, this basic incentive, this idea that like war is ruinous, therefore we have incentives not to do it, doesn't actually even require me to care about you. The basic assumption is the basic principle at work here is just the costs to me are enough that I should strive to avoid it. Now, so that is why, and I think we've seen that. I think even in a polarized state, I think our political parties, I think the vast majority of Americans sort of went up to the point of violence, this sort of semi-organized, semi-expressive event that happened on January 6th, and they said, we don't want to go any further. All right, and we have a whole set of institutions and law enforcement, I think, that have actually responded reasonably effectively since then. And so we haven't seen a repeat. And that makes me quite hopeful about the future.
You share a quote from former President Ronald Reagan in the book, "A peace is not the absence of conflict. It is the ability to handle conflict by peaceful means." And that, in some ways, is really encouraging. We're not expecting the Colombian gang members to, you know, give each other hugs and buy each other coffee. But they have an incentive, if they can recognize it, to not have their people shooting each other.
Right. And you know, there's all of these leaders have reminded us this throughout history. Winston Churchill said it's better to jaw-jaw than war-war. Mao told us that politics is war, war is politics with bloodshed. And von Clausewitz told us that war is just politics by other means. They're all telling us the exact same thing, that we have two ways to sort of get something from our adversary. We can do it violently, or we can do it nonviolently. And the fact is that these aren't equal means. One is incredibly costly. And so at all times, we at least try and often succeed in seeking the other path. And it's important. It's the idea, again, I bring it back to this idea that we should focus on the critically ill, right? We have to, our attention must be seized by what's happening now in a place like Ukraine, but we're not going to design the right, like a doctor who would design the wrong treatments if he was diagnosing everyone as critically ill, right? We're not going to get the right interventions and programs if we don't really understand these sort of normal incentives towards peace.
In our educational process, do you think we should have more focus on the times of peace, on the conflicts that didn't escalate into war and why that happened?
You know, I think we whenever we talk about periods of growth and democracy and development, these are implicitly times of actual peace. So I think we could just draw it out better. What I'd also like to see enter our curriculum are some of these more basic actual skills of conflict resolution. I mean, it does enter our curriculum, especially for young kids. But I mean, I think there are a lot of very basic skills that can enable us in our daily lives, in our organizations, in our government to actually avoid some of these five roots of war, and that would actually, you know, make this a slightly more stable life, stable society for us all.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Christopher Blattman. He studies global conflict, crime, and poverty at the University of Chicago. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.